Our next presenter hardly needs an introduction, Steve Lampman. He's been with us a number of times. He's always entertaining. We usually keep him for after lunch to keep everybody awake, so we're making an exception this morning. Steve's been with Belden for 19 years. He's the manager of multimedia technology and product line manager for entertainment products. What does that mean? You sell HDMI cables?
I'll talk about it.
Steve's published a couple of books. One is the Audio-Video Cable Installer's Pocket Hand Guide, and the other one is Wired for Sound, and the next book he's working on right now, and he used some of the information from last night, is going to be called Dead Air, and he can tell us a little bit about that. But today he's going to tell us about coax versus coax. You mean there's more than one kind of coax?
Maybe. Okay, thank you. Great to be back. I felt like I haven't even left, you know? I mean, these things come around so amazingly fast. And I'll tell you, the most interesting thing is I'm the perfect example of be careful what you wish for. Because, you know, 20 years ago, I wished I had a job where I could wander around the world schmoozing with engineers, which, of course, isn't a real job. I don't actually do anything. And I got my wish, and here I am 20 years later. The problem, of course, is that I'm in the middle of 3 weeks on the road without going home. My previous trip was 37 days. It was a record for me without going home. And three continents and Buenos Aires and Sao Paulo and Brazil and Argentina and Amsterdam and Canada. And I've left out all the U.S. cities. So, you know, the dog growls at me when I get home. And hi, I'm your husband. Remember me. And so, on the other hand, you know, I won't be able to do this forever. So if anybody wants to be my replacement, it sounds like a cool job, let me know. Because out of my 6,400 employees in Belden, I'm the only one doing what I do, which is not a real job. And so, in fact, what they did, and I realize now I had updated this, but I didn't give him the updated version. I have a second job title now, which he mentioned, which is product line manager for all the entertainment products, RF products. And what that simply means is they didn't know what I was doing for a living, so they gave me a real job. And that is to think up all the new products. Well, that's fine, because I had a list for years. And every 6 months, I would give a list to the guys who were doing new products with 100 ideas. Well, now this 100-idea list that I have is now my own list. So the whole point is this. If you have an idea for a new product, if you say, why don't you do this, you know, square wire, that would go really great on the reel, you know, or shielded fiber, you know what I mean? You can think of all interesting ideas, right? And the point is, if you have this strange idea that you'd like something to be made, I'm now the guy. I'm the idea guy. I had three ideas at NAB, which you brought out. I have four more coming at AES in a couple of weeks, all audio stuff. And believe me, so I'm working on my list of 100 things. I'd be glad to add your ideas to it. Okay, in the meanwhile. Now, the interesting thing is virtually everybody who's talked about wire and cable at this show and every other show is talking about IP. And I don't know if you noticed, if you've been to my talks before, virtually every talk I've ever given is about IP or twisted pairs or Cat5 or, you know, that kind of stuff. So I guess this is kind of poetic justice that now I'm talking about coax, you know? People saying, well, isn't coax going to die? Well, no. In fact, we're selling more coax than we've ever sold before. We're also selling more twisted pairs than we've ever sold before. So it's kind of hard to see where things are going. I have a feeling if coax does die and if twisted pairs die, it's because there's going to be some new technology coming out. And I could think of what these new technologies are, things like room temperature superconductors. Go Google that. They've been working on that for 20, 30 years. They're not even close. But if they could figure out how to do it, it would blow all this stuff away. There's also, you know, if you talk about string theory, there are 11 dimensions we live in. We only experience three. Hey, maybe I can communicate through those and talk about wireless. I could go through those other dimensions to get from place to place. I mean, yeah, this sounds like super crazy weird stuff. The point is, if it could actually work, all this stuff would be gone. So, and if you know what's happening, the whole point is, don't tell me, go see your stockbroker. That's how you get rich, is knowing what's coming next. Okay. So, and in fact, you've probably seen this slide before because I've shown it a few times. These are the guys who invented modern coax. And I say that because, in fact, coaxial cable is a fairly ancient thing. And I'm going to give you some prehistory before these guys. Because, in fact, the first patent for coax is dated 1888, I kid you not, by a guy named Oliver Heaviside, who was an engineer in England. Now, he was working with the telegraph in 1888. I mean, it wasn't even the telephone yet. There was a telephone, but barely. And he was inventing cables for the use with the telegraph, where you could actually have, you know, a hot wire and a ground wire. Well, that's pretty much what coax is when you think about it. The only difference is he's not talking about any frequencies on it. He's talking about DC, you know, on, off. This is the telegraph, right? And so there is a patent for that, but it has nothing to do with frequencies or anything else. And in fact, I have a piece at home, which I'd love to bring with me, but it's too valuable, of the original undersea telegraph cable from 1858. And in fact, if you Google this or eBay this, you'll find that back in the 1850s, when this guy Cyrus W. Field was trying to put telegraph cables under the ocean between England and the U.S., actually it was between Ireland and Nova Scotia, but, you know, pretty close, the whole point was that he tried this five times before he finally got one to actually work. Now, I can't imagine being an investment counselor at the time saying, oh, yeah, you know, let's do it again, you know, a few more million dollars, which back then was real money, you know. And it's amazing that this actually finally got put in and worked. And the interesting thing is, to raise money, one of the things he did was send some of this cable to Tiffany and Company in New York. They cut into little pieces, they put a little plaque on it. And I have one of these. That's what I have at home, is a piece of the original undersea telegraph cable. And it looks exactly like coax. It's got one copper wire down the center, covered in gutta percha, which is uncured rubber, and then steel wires on the outside of that. But that's all for protection. You see, those steel wires weren't part of the signal carrying. So when these guys came for a patent, for instance, they brought out this telegraph cable from 1858 and said, what about that? Well, the steel wires weren't for carrying anything. Where by the time 1888 rolled around, that was actually the ground portion. That was a harder patent for them to talk about. But what these guys did was look at coax in a completely different way. And this was because they were trying to do one simple thing, send 1,000 telephone calls between cities. You see, back in the 1915, that was a red letter day for the telephone company, red letter year, because in San Francisco, my hometown, they had the San Francisco Panama Pacific International Exposition, which celebrated the opening of the Panama Canal. And one of the things they showed in the Hall of Tomorrow was the new telephone from coast to coast. Never been done before. And they made a telephone call. Theodore N. Vail, who was head of the telephone company, called President Woodrow Wilson in the White House and talked to him. Now, you have to realize that twisted pairs can only go 13,000 feet, 2.5 miles, before you run out of steam for lots of reasons, the wrong impedance, high capacitance, all sorts of things. So even a 3 kilohertz audio signal, which is simple, won't go forever. That's, in fact, still the distance between you and your central office is 2.5 miles. You know, of course, now we're trying to get a T1 or, you know, DS3, or you tell me 2.5 miles, but the point is it's still that same distance. And so they had this telephone call. Now, how did they do this? Well, every 2 miles there had to be an amplifier on this pair of wires, which meant 1,500 amplifiers from coast to coast for one pair of wires to make one telephone call. And you realize 1915 was only 9 years... 9 years after the invention of the Audion, the first tube to amplify, right? So this was real early technology, and the fact that it actually worked was amazing. They made a second call from Tom Watson, you know, the guy who'd been Bell's assistant. He was still alive in 1915, and he called Alexander Graham Bell, who was in Canada, on another line with another 1,500 amplifiers. And they realized, you know, this is crazy. If we're going to do coast-to-coast telephone calls, which everybody wanted to do, they thought it was a great idea, We can't have billions of tubes out there, you know, it'd be impossible. The reliability would be zero. And so they gave this problem to these guys and said, figure out how to send 1,000 telephone calls from city to city. Well, they looked at twisted pairs. Now, twisted pairs in 1929 were pretty horrible. And they already knew that. They could only go a couple of miles, maybe. And so they said, okay, we're going to have to invent something else. What's the problem with a twisted pair? Well, the first thing is the impedance variations are all over the map. Now, what is impedance? Well, we'll talk about that in a while. And what is the correct impedance? Nobody knew that at the time. You know, is there a good one or bad impedance? You know, they knew there were different impedances, but what do they mean? And so they thought, okay, the first thing we're going to do, the first thing that Lloyd Espenscheid did was he said, well, we have to lock the two conductors together somehow so they can't move. And this is when he hit upon the idea of using this idea of coaxial cable. And you can see him holding a piece of his original coax cable there, giant. It's like hard line, like the stuff you're putting up the tower now. Very, very much the same kind of thing. Giant center conductor and, you know, a large copper tube on the outside and something in between that's a non-conductor. I mean, you know, that hasn't changed. And the point is, if I take a slice of this cable or any other coax like it and I draw a line through it, you see it splits it in half. It's like a big pie, right? And everything splits in half, which is why I would say that everything in this design is on the same axis. Everything is coaxial. That's why it's coaxial cable. There's a picture of modern coax. This is like 1505 or 1694, one of our video coaxes. It's essentially the same thing. The design hasn't changed at all. Okay, but I've mentioned impedance, something that they knew was important. The question, they really didn't know what was important about it, except that it varied in the twisted pair, and by putting it in coax, they could get it to be stable, to stay at one value. Now, what is this? Well, it's really two things. It's either the electrical parameters or it's the physical parameters of the cable. Now, this one shows the physical parameters. You show me, for instance, the size of the center conductor, you give me that number, or gauge, or something that tells me the size. And you show me the distance between the center conductor and the shield between the two conductors. That's fine. That's a perfect dimension. And then you tell me what kind of stuff did you put in between those two layers. A number called the dielectric constant that tells me how good it is. You know, it could be air. Yeah, you have air core cables, right? You have plastic in there. I could put foamed plastic. I could put wood pulp. You know, I could put celery. Something non-conductive in there. They all have a dielectric constant, and I could then take those three numbers and with a very simple formula tell you the impedance of this cable, whatever it might be. Now, the interesting thing is, of course, if I change any of these three, I'm going to change the impedance of the cable. Oh, duh. So if I'm trying to hit a certain value, I'm really talking about the ratio of sizes between these three things, you know, the plastic and the distances and the size of stuff. But the interesting thing is, by telling me these dimensions, without even realizing it, you've already told me the electrical parameters. For instance, if you tell me the size of that center conductor, you know, in inches or millimeters or wire gauge or something, I can look right up in my catalog or any other catalog, gauge size resistance per unit length, you know, 100 feet something. I can tell you how many ohms that is. So by telling me the size, you've told me the resistance automatically. And since you've told me the size of that conductor, you've also told me the inductance of that, you know? And in fact, cables have very, very low inductance. It's so low, we never even mentioned it in the catalog. But there is inductance there. It's some tiny piece of a microhenry per unit length. And the interesting thing is, since I've told you the distance between the center conductor and the shield, and there's a non-conductor in between, you can suddenly recognize, hey, that's a capacitor, you know? Two metal plates with a non-conductor in between. That must have some capacitance, and indeed it does. And so, in fact, you've told me R, L, and C, the three electrical parameters that I need to be able to tell what the impedance of a cable is. And there's another formula that looks suspiciously like the formula for dimensions that tells me the electrical version of the same thing and comes out to exactly the same number in impedance. Now, of course, There's one thing I'll show you in a second, that impedance changes with frequency, and eventually it levels out into something called the characteristic impedance, which is really the impedance that you are concerned about. Now, here's the theoretical value. I don't know if you could read those formulas from here. The interesting thing is if I say, what's the formula for impedance? And if you knew one, well, first of all, it meant you read a book, right? Or you went to a class, right? And the one that you know is the one on the right, the high frequency one, which is Z, the impedance, equals square root of L over C. So you take L, you take C, you divide them, take a square root, that's pretty simple, and you end up with an impedance. But you look on the low frequency one on the left, which you can just barely see from here, I think it'd be better focused, and you'll notice in that formula is a very large R, the resistance. Well, wait a minute, where was the R in that right formula? There's no R there, but there's a ton of R in the left formula. Ah, because there's an effect occurring on the cable, which occurs on every cable, twisted pairs, coax, doesn't matter what it is, which as you get higher and higher in frequency, you have something called skin effect. And what happens there is the signal moves from using the whole conductor at low frequencies, like DC, that's the whole conductor. As the frequencies get higher and higher, it moves to the outside of the conductor, to just the skin of the conductor. And by the time you're at really high frequencies, you know, in the megahertz kind of high frequencies, then only the skin of the conductor is actually working. You could actually have a tube or copper-clad steel. That's why we have copper-clad steel conductors, because that steel isn't carrying anything. This is high-frequency stuff. Only that copper layer is actually carrying the signal. So the whole point is, okay, at low frequencies, however, as this effect is occurring, it's changing the impedance. So at low frequencies, now I don't know if you could read this, this starts at 100 megahertz. Oh, I have a pointer here. 100, I don't know if you can see this little red thing. Where are we? Here we are. 100 megahertz down here, 10 megahertz, 1 megahertz, 100 kilohertz, 10 kilohertz, 1 kilohertz, 100 hertz, 10 hertz. Okay, we're starting at 10 hertz. That's a pretty low frequency, wouldn't you say? At 10 hertz, you look at the impedance, it's like 4,000 ohms. And as we go higher and higher in frequency, the impedance starts to come down. And eventually it gets to what's called the characteristic impedance, this blue line here, where the resistance doesn't make any difference at all. There's no R in the formula anymore. It's a straight line. And you could make that straight line anywhere. You could make it 75, 50, 23, 108, pick a number, you know? The question is, what number do you need? And when is impedance important? Well, it's important because of wavelengths. And the whole point is, impedance and wavelength are actually connected in a very interesting way. If you can tell the length of the wave, and I'll talk about this in more detail in just a second, when you get to a quarter of a wavelength, and you antenna guys will suddenly say, oh, I know what that is, a quarter of a wavelength, yes, of course. That's where the impedance of a cable begins to be important. So if you can tell me the frequency you're running at, I can calculate the wavelength, I can divide it by four, get a quarter wavelength. If your cable's that long, then knowing the impedance is important. We still haven't decided which impedance is, you know, what impedance is important. There's the wave, there's the length of a wave, and the interesting thing is you can see why a quarter wave is the important part, because that's where the signal is at its maximum, of course. You know, we go quarter of a wave maximum, and then it goes down, you know, below and comes back up again, and you have a whole wave. That's one wavelength. At a quarter wave, it will have its maximum effect. So we're going to look at frequencies and determine a quarter wavelength. Okay, here's the formula. It's very simple. The wavelength in meters, we can convert it back to feet if we need to. 300 million divided by F, the frequency. So at 1 megahertz, that's 300 meters divided by 4, 75 meters. So if you're at 1 megahertz on a cable, you don't have to really think about what the cable's doing until you're at 246 feet, or 75 meters. That's when it's important. If you're at 10 megahertz, I'm at 25 feet. Oh, you see, now suddenly things are getting more and more critical. And if at 54 megahertz, which is channel 2, you know, or used to be channel 2, still kind of channel 2, you're at 5 feet. And you'll notice what this means is, if I'm getting into TV stuff or FM stuff, that a few feet of cable is suddenly important. I'm into single-digit feet. So I need to know what the impedance of the cable is. How about the connector? Who cares? It's an inch. It's a half an inch. It won't show up. At least, not yet. Not yet. Okay, 100 megahertz. This is like 100 base T data, you know, twisted pairs. 3 feet, 2.5 feet. A gigahertz, 3 inches. And you realize by the time you get to a gigahertz, for instance, 3 inches is getting darn close to connector kinds of values. So maybe you should start thinking about this, and you don't just have one connector at the end of each cable and that's it. No, you have a bunch of connectors, you know, cable one, cable two, cable three, in and out, patch panels, and, you know, all these things all together. And you have a bunch of connectors, so maybe you should start thinking about connectors if you're at higher frequencies. By the time you're at 10 gigahertz, oh, clearly, 0.3 inches, I mean, obviously, that means everything is critical at 10 gigahertz. And this is why you talk to those microwave guys. You maybe have been one, you know, and they say, oh, this is all voodoo, because you look at it and it changes. That's because of that value. It means anything is going to have an effect. You put your hand in there, it has an effect, you know. You move something, it has an effect, because we're at such high frequencies. And the point is also, when you're talking about wavelength, you really have to look at the speed of the signal on the cable. That is to say, the speed of the signal compared to the speed of light. Now, if I have a cable that's made with polyethylene inside, the world's most common plastic, that has a speed of 66% the speed of light. If I put Teflon in there, the world's most expensive plastic, because DuPont owns it, you know, that's 70% the speed of light. But I can take all of these and I can do one very clever thing to improve, and that is to foam the interior and get even higher velocities. In fact, I can show you cables. I didn't bring any cables here today to pass out, but they're all in the next room over there. I forgot. And you can come over and I can show you a cable that is 86% velocity. That's the highest velocity we've ever made in a foamed, regular kind of cable. Yes, you can get hard line that has air dielectric in it that's approaching 95, 96% velocity, pretty high. By the time you get to 100% velocity, that's a vacuum. You'd have to have evacuated cable, which is kind of hard to buy, you know? Actually, I saw some evacuated speaker cables not too long ago. I kid you not. And the point is, it had valves at the end. If you turned the valve and the air came in, you had to send it back to get it re-evacuated, you know? These were like 10 grand a piece, I kid you not. Yeah, the Consumer Electronics Show, of course. Where else, right? So, here are our friends, Herman and Lloyd Espenscheid and Herman Offel, at Bell Labs trying to make their coaxes. And the question is, what impedance to make the coax? And so what they did was very simple. And if you've even heard these experiments were so famous, you've heard them even though you don't know it's these guys who did them, they went to the hardware store and they got copper pipe of every size imaginable that they could buy. And the point is you take a big one and you put in a small one and you make sure it's in the center and then you can read the impedance of that. And you take out the little one and put in a bigger one, or take the big one, make it smaller or do something, you get another impedance. And so the point is, they could make cables, I'm sure they couldn't go down to zero, which it says on the chart here. They could extrapolate to zero. They probably get 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, maybe more than 100. We go up to 124 ohms, go down to 32 ohms in our catalog, for instance. So they could certainly do those kinds of values. And then they were interested in three things, very simple. The top one is the attenuation of the signal. Signal attenuation, very basic. The bottom two on the left is power in watts, you know those guys, and voltage in volts, you know those guys. And they were interested in all three of these because here's what they were going to do. They went out and they bought an AM transmitter. And they modified this AM transmitter to take an input, which was not just audio, but 1,000 pieces of audio. And this was Lloyd Espenscheid's other great invention at the time. Was how to put 1,000 telephone calls on a single cable. Well, duh, we do this all the time now. We call it multiplexing, where you have, you know, a single cable going into TV with 500 channels. You know, 200 are Gilligan's Island reruns, and 200 are Dukes Hazzard reruns, and the rest are infomercials. But you have 500 to choose from on one cable, and then they send you a bill, right? So the whole point is, this is what he invented, is spacing by frequency. We would call them channels, you know, or something else like that. And so he could take 1,000 audio channels, 1,000 telephone calls, say 3,500 hertz, you know, something like that, 3,000 hertz. And 1,000 of that would be 3.5 megahertz, which in those days, that was wide bandwidth stuff. 3.5 megahertz of audio. Pretty amazing. And the point is, he would modify his AM transmitter to be able to handle 3.5 megahertz of bandwidth, which was pretty amazing when you think about it. And then this transmitter would transmit out into this transmission line, thinking it's going to see an antenna somewhere. Of course, it doesn't. It simply goes down this transmission line to the next city. But he's going to start with high power, high voltage, you know, tubes, remember those things, glow FETs, you know. And so he would need, you know, high voltage, high power in order for this to work. And by the time they had done, By the time they had finished this, I'm sure this was a very black day for them to realize that there was no perfect impedance for any of these things. They were all different. You want perfect voltage? You get 60 ohms. You want perfect power? You get 30 ohms. You want low attenuation? Well, this one you'll understand. You use 75 ohms. That's why when you have small signals that have no power, no voltage, really, like a video signal, what is it, 1 volt? I know that's not true. Digital signals are 0.8 volts, right? Essentially no voltage. How much power is on a video signal? Nothing, you know, milliwatts, microwatts, nothing. So the only one you're concerned with for video would be the attenuation one, which says use 75 ohms. And that's why all the video is 75 ohms, all the cable TV broadband is 75 ohms, all the satellite downlinking, not up, but the downlinking is 75. See, up is power. Up the transmission, up to the antenna, that's power and voltage. And so the problem was there's no perfect line for power and voltage, except, of course, you know this. The thing that kills your transmission lines, the thing that stands on the line when things go wrong, is voltage, right? Vizwar, that's a V for voltage. It's not pizwar. It's not power. Okay? So the point is, so voltage is the most important, but if I pick 60 ohms, I could barely see this dot. If you can pick 60 ohms, there's 60 ohms. Look at the power handling at 60 ohms. It's less than 50% power handling. And I thought, well, geez, I mean, you know, we're going to lose half our power for no reason except I want to get really good voltage handling. And so they compromised, and they moved further down. And they eventually got to this compromise value of 50 ohms. That's a compromise value. But you notice, if you look in anybody's catalog, including ours, we would make 51 ohms and 51 and a half and 52. And all those are trying to head to 60 for better voltage handling without really destroying your power handling. But that's how we got to 50. So 50 and 75 are the two we know. 75 is a real value. 50 is a compromise value. Now the center conductor. Well, it depends on what you're doing. If you're doing low frequencies and high frequencies, you need an all-copper center conductor. This is why our video cables are all copper, because we really don't know what you're going to do in them. Some people put analog. You ever heard of analog video? It's the latest thing. They put it on these cables, and therefore you need all-copper center conductors, because that's going to go down to DC, you know? If you have tin copper, well, you realize right away that tin is there to protect the copper underneath. But if you're going to run it at high frequency, guess what? That's where the signal's going to be, in the tin. So a tin copper conductor cannot be a higher frequency conductor. It has to be below 100 kilohertz. In other words, an audio conductor. Those are tinned because there's no skin effect or very little skin effect. Silver-coated copper. Ooh, that's cool and expensive, as you can imagine. But you want really good conductivity, especially high frequencies, that's the way to go. The interesting thing is you notice one of the places we use silver-coated copper is really on conductors that have Teflon around them. And that's because some of the ways we put Teflon on cables is very corrosive. There's fluorine in Teflon, and it corrodes the copper. Copper corrosion, that green stuff, is a semiconductor. Bad news. When silver corrodes, silver oxide is exactly the same conductivity as silver. So therefore, you put a silver layer there, and nothing happens. Everything's just fine. So very often it's how we make the cable that determines what we put on the conductor, not just the fact that we're trying to get a good or bad conductor. Copper-clad steel. Most of your cable TV cables are copper-clad steel, except think about this for a while. If you have copper-clad steel, it really starts to work about, a couple of megahertz, 10 megahertz, say, and by the time you're at 50 megahertz, it's seriously into the skin. But you look at the cable TV cable people, what are they trying to do? Send you signals below that. You know, those A channels and T channels, I don't even know whether you know what they're down there. Way low frequencies. Well, guess what? Those are in the steel. You can't use steel conductors. That's 7 times more resistance than copper. That's crazy. You need an all-copper conductor. And a lot of times you need an all-copper conductor for something else, like for satellite dishes, downlink satellite dishes. We sell you all-copper for those. Why? Because there's a little amplifier in the dish that needs to be powered. Where's the power come from? From the cable. That's DC. Frequency, nothing, right? So you need all-copper to get up there. So you have all-copper to get to the power and a skin to bring the signal back, but it better be an all-copper conductor. And then we have weird things like silver-coated copper-clad steel. I mean, you can get totally crazy here. Those are mil-spec cables, and a lot of times we do that because of the plastics we're putting in the outside. How am I doing for time here? I guess I'm okay. I guess they'll wave me down. And this is kind of telling you what you already know. You know, thinner, thinner, thinner to the outside. You can actually calculate the depth, the skin depth, if you want to. Here's the skin depth in copper. It's a pretty simple formula. 2.61 divided by the square root of the frequency. So if you know the frequency you're working at, this will come out in inches, by the way, the way this is because of 2.61. This is, by the way, only for copper. Silver and everything else would be a different number. And this shows you the depth, the skin depth. You don't have to read this except to know, obviously, as you go higher and higher in frequency, you can see the skin depth gets smaller and smaller. We started at 2 millimeters and ended up at 2 microns at a gigahertz. 2 microns of skin depth. And the same thing in inches. Now, here's the size of conductor, 59 and 6 and 11 common sizes of conductors. And you see the sizes. So I'm going to compare the size of the conductor to the skin depth, okay? And, of course, the skin depth happens on both sides of the conductor. You know what I mean? It's skin. And so the point is, here's RG59. And you look at 1 megahertz. How much of the conductor is being used at 1 megahertz? 26% of the conductor. A lot. Which means you better have a pretty good amount of skin on there. You see, you just can't have any skin. You got to know how much skin. And if you intend to carry a megahertz, you better have a lot of skin. Maybe you just get to bare copper and be done with it. Don't have to worry about how much skin there is. By the time you're at a gigahertz, less than 1% of that conductor is now being used. So if you're going to do high-frequency stuff, just make sure the skin is okay. In fact, this is one reason why when we're talking about HD and 1080p and video beyond that, is the one thing we do is we do a lot of work on the outside of the conductor before we actually put it into the cable. In fact, we do so much work on it, I can't even begin to tell you. They're all trade secrets. Way back when I began to talk about this kind of stuff, I actually was talking about the kind of things we do until an engineer sat into my presentation and said,
"Those are trade secrets."
Okay, all right, so I stopped talking about them. Not that other people can't figure it out, too. I mean, how do you make a mirror-finish, perfect-sized conductor? They know how. It's not the knowing. It's the doing that's the problem. Here's RG59 on a 20-gauge solid. By the way, this last one was 24-gauge solid. You know, 20 RG59 comes in variations on a theme. And you'll notice with a larger conductor, by the time we're at a gigahertz, we're at 0.5%, even less, because it's a bigger conductor. This is RG6, we're at 0.42%, and you get the idea, at RG11, 0.26%, a quarter of a percent by the time you're at the gigahertz. And this shows one interesting thing. People say, well, wait a minute, if at high frequency you're talking about the skin, then what difference does the size of the cable make, because you're not using that whole conductor? Yeah, but a big cable has more skin, therefore better conductor. It's amount of surface area then, not about conductivity. It's not about resistance. Bare copper, copper clad, we've already talked about those, kind of. Now, you can go out and buy. Here's, if you actually went out and bought your copper, this is what you buy. ASTM, the American Society of Testing and Materials. And these are the standards. There's B452. I mean, there's many different standards. I'm just showing you one. B452, which comes in two grades, 40% and 30%. And it shows you 40% would be 10% of the conductor's copper and the rest is steel. 30% would be 6% of the conductor's copper and the rest is steel. And see, if you go to Fonghua, they'll sell you something that's 2% is copper and the rest is steel. But boy, is it cheap. The question is, does it work? You know? Well, yeah, it sort of works, you know? It looks okay from the outside. You can certainly see the copper. Yeah, but, you know. And then you have this other one, STMB 869, now it's changed. That's 21% layer, 3% of the conductor is copper. Oh, I bet that stuff is really cheap, you know? And a lot easier for them to make, to put the copper layer on. So the whole point is, here's the three grades. There is various frequencies, and I'm only going up to 60 megahertz here. And you'll notice this, and the worst one, look at the 21% line, copper-clad steel, 21%. At 60 megahertz, I'm using 92% of that layer. That's great. As long as you're staying above 60 megahertz, you're probably just as fine. Down at 1 megahertz, 11%. I'm missing 90% of my signal is in the steel wire. So be careful what you wish for. Solid copper versus copper clad. Obviously, bare copper is 100% all the time. The problem with bare copper, of course, is it's more expensive. Well, sort of. Copper clad steel is not that cheap. But certainly, bare copper is softer. It's easier to bend. That's one thing that people like about copper clad steel. It's really hard, especially if you're going to put an F connector on there, which uses the center of the cable as the conductor for the connector, which God never designed cables to actually be the connector, but in this case, that's the way it ended up. I have all sorts of slides showing what actually happens to the center conductor when you expose it to air, which it was never designed to be exposed to. And they're not pretty, but I haven't put them in here. And of course, there's dielectric constant, that stuff in between. I can use really crappy stuff like PVC. You really don't see that in coax. It's so horrible. More like polyethylene, the first one to be used in coax commonly. Teflon, chemically foamed polyethylene, gas-injected foam polyethylene. That stuff that's 86% velocity is all gas-injected foam. We actually put the bubbles in as we're melting the plastic onto the wire. This is all in one step. And by the way, if you want to see this, you're welcome to come to any of our 17 factories. We have 17 factories around the world. You're welcome to come to any of them, and we'll show you this process being done. It's pretty amazing because we're putting billions of little bubbles on top of inside plastic as it's being extruded around the wire, and we're doing it with such consistency we know exactly what the dielectric constant is when it's going to come out. You think about that. No wonder it's hard to make this stuff. Okay, and you're going to multiply the wavelength by the velocity just because it affects how far you can go, what the speed is going to be. Shields.
I hope I have enough time here.
Okay. Different kinds of shields. A spiral shield, braid shield. There's something called a French braid, which is two spirals braided along one axis. And foil. Most of you know braid, most of you know foil. If it's a really fancy cable, it's braid and foil. Now, here's an interesting chart, and I wish I had data. I'm asking for data beyond 500 megahertz now, because I'd like to show you what happens at the gigahertz. What this is very simple. We took a piece of hard line. It looks like a piece of hard line, but you take out the center conductor, so it's a big copper tube. You have a tray in there that you can put a piece of cable on inside. And then you bring the cable to the outside of this, you attach to the center conductor only, and then you put a signal onto the outside of the giant copper tube, to the hard line. And the whole point is, what you're trying to do is see how much of this signal radiates to the inside. It gets to the center conductor. Because, you know, what goes in is going to be what comes out as well. And if it goes in really easily, it's going to come out really easily. And this is called transfer impedance. It's transferring the signal from the outside to the inside of the cable. And if it doesn't, if we got no transfer impedance, you'd have a perfect coax with a perfect shield. And we're showing at different frequencies, starting at 5 megahertz. And you'll notice, and a bigger number means more stuff is getting through, so it's bad. So, for instance, that first one, 60% braid bonded foil, that's your cable TV cable at home, I guarantee you. That's the most common variety of cable TV cable. You look at the transfer impedance at 5 megahertz, it's crap. Well, luckily, we don't do video at 5 megahertz. You know, we start at 50 megahertz, where it's 11. Okay, that's okay, you know. And it doesn't get much better after that, okay? Very, very cheap cable. And then you go down to 60% braid tri-shield, foil braid foil. And you see how dramatically the numbers improve, just because of one extra layer. But you go down, for instance, my two favorite are the bottom ones, 80% braid tri-shield, foil braid foil, but higher braid coverage. And you notice those really good numbers. And then we get to the last one. Now, the last one is all our video cables, all our fancy, expensive cables that you're buying. It's a copper braid, not aluminum braid, copper braid and foil. And it's as high as we can go in a braid, 95% braid. And you see those numbers are fantastically good, which they should be because you're paying a lot of money for that cable. But you go out and try and buy a cable TV cable that's made like that, give me a break. No, can't buy it. Of course, I could sell you fancy video cable. You could use that. It's 75 ohms. I mean, I have 6094 running throughout my entire house, running cable TV. What overkill? Yeah, except I get fantastically good shield effectiveness numbers. And since I'm looking right at Sutro Tower, where I used to work, you know, I need this shield effectiveness there. So my cable TV looks great. Of course, the cable is kind of expensive, but I got a special deal. So, and then the jacket over the whole thing. You know, you don't have to have a jacket. We make cables with no jackets on them. You use cables, you know. Hardline has no jacket on it. Of course, you put a jacket on it, that will protect it. And that's really what it does. It protects. It doesn't have any effect on the performance of the cable, but it will keep it longer, keep it good longer. And, of course, then we can identify it, we can print on it, we can tell you what it is, you know. If there's a fire rating or something, we can tell you what that is, so on. And the jacket does have some effect on its flammability, so that might be some way we'll choose what jacket material to use. And, of course, it's what the connector holds onto. And the colors, if we're going to color the cable, it's going to be a jacket color. The insides, well, we did do a cable that had the insides colored, and that was an interesting experiment. It did work, but it was very, very expensive to do. We were doing RGB cables where the interiors were colored, you see. Yeah, sounds. Isn't that a clever idea? It just was 5 times more expensive because each one's a different color, right? So, resistance, you understand, capacitance. You know, if we get the gas-injected foam, you can see, just looking in the catalog, we're talking about things like 16 picofarads per foot. If you have solid polyethylene, it's like 20. If you put PVC in there, you'd have like 50. I mean, it would be virtually unusable for anything even moderately high frequency. And of course, now you understand there is such a thing as transfer impedance. If you talk to anybody else about coax cables, say, what's the transfer impedance at frequency X, you know? Ooh, and then you see little beads of sweat appear because you're asking this question that you're not supposed to know anything about, right? That's a serious question. Return loss. In fact, I want to come back next year and give you my latest version of a presentation I gave here probably 5 or 6 or 7 years ago on return loss, because we're now into 1080p and heading rapidly into 4K and 8K. I mean, you think we're at the end of video? Oh, not at all. And this is where the rubber meets the road here, return loss, impedance variations. And if I can get impedance variations down to 0, I have a perfect cable. Can anybody do that? No. But we're getting closer all the time. I mean, here's good return loss. And what you're seeing is signals going in 2 directions. The stuff going up is the return. That's the stuff reflecting back to the source. And so the thing is, when I mash a cable, Here's a mashed cable. I actually stomped on it and tightened knots and squeezed it with pliers. And you can see the damage, you know. That damage, here's the previous cable, you know, and here's it after it's damaged. And that simply means more of the signal is reflecting the wrong way. Less the signal gets to the other end. That's what's called return loss, right? It returns, goes where it's not supposed to go, returns to the source, and doesn't show up at the other end. If I do something like put wire ties on it every foot and then use my wire tie gun to make sure they're really tight, I can get this effect on a cable that you really can't see at all. A periodic effect. I've picked a wavelength, you see. I picked a wavelength, and once I've picked that wavelength and repeated it over and over again, I pick up not only a fundamental frequency, but every harmonic of that frequency. How do you get away from that? Tie them by hand. Don't put them at the same distance apart. Or just use Velcro ties, something that doesn't put pressure on cables. That's my solution. And I'll show you, next year, I'll show you more slides of that. This is what happens if you put a 50-ohm feed-through BNC in the middle of a good 75-ohm line. And you'll notice one interesting thing. Analog, you know, 4 megahertz, 6 megahertz analog would work. It doesn't care. It's at minus 30, minus 40, which is a pretty good number over there. By the time you're up into digital, this goes up to 3 gigahertz here, which is, you know, serious digital time. You have so much reflection, you're at 10% reflection. That minus 10 is the equivalent of 10% reflection. And most of the times, the chip will just shut down. Ah, okay. And here's what they mean. If you can get the 30 dB, 99.9% good. 10 dB is horrible. 15 dB is the SMPTE maximum limit for all things combined. And I have run out of time. Thank you for listening. And if you have questions, I'll be in the booth for the next couple hours.